Welcome into Words with Wallace. I'm your host, Nick Wallace. Coming at you, it's Friday, June 27th, little Friday afternoon pod. Hopefully you guys are gearing up for a great weekend. I'm sitting here about 24 hours removed from the 2025 NBA draft. Certainly not the most eventful draft that we've ever seen, but a fun couple of nights of watching the draft on TV nonetheless. As you guys know by now, I'm definitely not the biggest college basketball guy. I certainly cannot pretend to be experts on these prospects. And so what I'm not going to do is go through every team and give draft grades and everything like that, because I have no idea which one of these guys are going to pan out. So the way I'm going to interpret what we watched over the past couple of days is spend some time on the top five picks and the fit of those prospects, just because I do have some familiarity at the top of the draft. But I really want to focus on the transactions, right? We saw a bunch of different trades on draft night. Really one that took the cake as easily the most shocking move of the entire draft, and I definitely want to dive into that quite a bit. Also want to focus on some teams in particular, like the Nets, who had a really busy night. The Raptors made a very controversial decision to move on from President of Basketball Operations Masai Ujiri earlier today, so they let him get one more draft off and then let him go, so I'm going to give you my thoughts on that. Of course, at the end, I do have to give you my draft winners and losers for what it's worth, but you can take that with a grain of salt. And then I have a couple things that I would change about the NBA draft on the way out the door on today's podcast. So, loaded pod, as usual, let's not waste any time and get right into it. So let's start the draft talk off by going through the top five picks in the 2025 NBA draft. These are guys that if you like basketball, if you care about the NBA, you're probably already pretty familiar with these guys yourselves. But let's start with the Mavs and Cooper Flagg nonetheless. I mean, I really don't have much to say on Cooper Flagg that hasn't already been said. As I'm sitting there watching on draft night, I cannot believe how lucky the Mavericks got to get this guy at the top of the draft with them being a playoff team for most of the year, right? Having championship aspirations for most of the year. Then they trade Luka, you know, Kyrie gets hurt, AD gets hurt. They fall down the standings. They're still in the play-in race in the Western Conference, and they come away with the number one pick in a draft that's pretty good and a draft that truly does have what some are arguing as a generational prospect at the top of the draft. I don't know if I'd go that far on Cooper Flagg. I'm not super buttoned up when it comes to draft evaluation and everything like that. But this is certainly a more valuable number one pick than we've seen in many years, including last year when it was the Hawks and Reece Achay at the top. So obviously this guy does everything well. He's got a super high floor. One thing that I found really entertaining coming out of the Mavs draft was another quote from Nico Harrison has dropped. Basically, he was talking about how lucky they got to get Cooper Flagg, and so his quote was, "Fortune favors the bold," referring in part to the Luka trade that he made at the deadline last year. So it seems like he's just kind of leaning into it. At first I was just like, man, like, fuck that guy. Really, the exact thought that pops into my head every single time Nico Harrison speaks post-Luka trade is something along those lines. But as I really thought about it, I'm like, maybe he's just kind of leaning into the villain thing at this point. Like, knowing that everybody hates him, knowing that everybody wants him fired, and knowing that, you know, he's taking a little bit of credit for just absolute dumb luck at the top of the lottery to get this really fantastic prospect. But whatever, fortune favors the bold. So that's why the Mavs ended up with Cooper Flagg, if you guys are wondering why. To recap how this fits in with the rest of the Mavericks offseason so far, they have been busy already. They re-signed Kyrie to a 3 years, $119 million contract. I don't love the price, but I don't hate it either. I mean, if you're going to be all in to win championships over the next couple of years, like Nico Harrison claims, you kind of have to have Kyrie as a part of that. And you know, he has still some leverage with that in mind, even though he's coming off the torn ACL. So while $40 million a year for 3 years for a dude who is an older guard, who is coming off a significant injury, you don't love that price, but they couldn't afford to let Kyrie walk. So it kind of is what it is. They also re-signed Daniel Gafford at 3 years, $60 million. I think this one was a little bit more puzzling because of the logjam that they have in the front court right about now with Derek Lively and Anthony Davis. We know Anthony Davis doesn't want to play the five. He's made that very clear, and the Mavs are trying to honor that wish. But it's like, dude, at some point, especially now that you have Cooper Flagg in the mix, like, I personally feel like when healthy, the Mavs' best lineup is going to be Kyrie, either Klay or Najee Marshall, depending on the matchup, then PJ Washington, then Cooper Flagg, and then Anthony Davis. I feel like that gives them the floor spacing and still gives them a lot of upside on the defensive end of the court, but they still feel committed to the idea of Anthony Davis at the five. Maybe, you know, Lively's had his own injury issues themselves. And look, $20 million a year for Gafford isn't a bad price. I just sit there and kind of wonder, like, why they needed to invest more into a bench front court position, given that you have Anthony Davis, Derek Lively, and could even get away with PJ Washington and Cooper Flagg at the four, but whatever. So I'm interested to see where the Mavs go from here, just because people are kind of forgetting that Kyrie is going to be hurt heading into next year. We'll see how much time that he misses at the start of the year. They need to do something at the guard position to hold down that point guard spot until Kyrie gets back into the lineup. You know, maybe the answer's in-house with Jaden Hardy and Brandon Williams that have had flashes the past couple of years. Maybe they bring back an old friend in Spencer Dinwiddie. I think that would be a miserable move. There have been D'Angelo Russell's whispers, so I do think the Mavs, like, when healthy, could be a team that contends as soon as next year if everything breaks right and Cooper hits some of that ceiling that we want him to in year one, or at least is on the right track. But the problem is just that they're coming into the year banged up with the Kyrie injury, and the West is really loaded. So we'll see where they go from here, but Cooper Flagg is a no-brainer decision, so the Mavs have to be happy about that. Moving on to the second pick, Dylan Harper to the Spurs. Again, didn't watch a ton of Rutgers this year, but this guy's a big guard, and by all accounts, he is the best pick-and-roll player in this year's draft. That's what every single expert said. So it's kind of a no-brainer when you get a guy, a weapon like Victor Wembanyama, the best guy on the other end of that proposition in the entire NBA. It could be really scary. I think what's interesting is just that the fit is a little clunky alongside guys that they already have in place in the Spurs building, in Stephon Castle and De'Aaron Fox. My guess is that Castle ends up coming off the bench like he did for most of this past year. He didn't really start starting until the end of the year once De'Aaron Fox was out and hurt and everything like that. But I do think the Spurs, when you have a guy like Victor Wembanyama, who's just such a dominant defensive player, he erases so many of those concerns on that end of the court where you could probably get away with starting a lineup of Fox, Castle, and Harper out there at all the same time, because Castle is a plus defender already and is much tougher than most guys his height at like 6'4", 6'5", and Harper being a bigger guy at 6'6", like really the only guy you have to worry about there is Fox. So assuming that Castle or Harper might be able to guard wings under the right situation, maybe we see them roll out a three-guard lineup to start. Crazier stuff has happened. But I do think that this pick in general, it's the right pick. They took best player available by all accounts. Harper's been a very premium prospect and has been number two throughout this entire draft process, so it makes sense. But it does make De'Aaron Fox more expendable, right? It seems like the Spurs, they flirted with the idea of trading for a guy like Kevin Durant, you know, moving that timeline up a little bit, but they decided, hey, we got Wemby. He's young enough. He's our future. Let's get some other guys on his timeline. And now they have somewhat of a big three, right? Obviously, very early to tell. But with Wemby, Castle, and Harper, I think that's the future in San Antonio. So we'll see what Fox ends up doing if they end up moving him at some point. I don't think that's going to happen this offseason by any means. But for what they paid for Fox, I think the move to get him still makes sense. And there are going to be some other teams that are in need of his services. So we'll see how that all works out in San Antonio. At number three, this is where the Philadelphia 76ers selected VJ Edgecombe. I'm not going to lie, guys. Like, I knew a little bit about VJ Edgecombe. I knew he's obviously played kind of in my backyard here at Baylor and Waco. Kind of bummed out I didn't get to watch Baylor play at all this year. I definitely got to make it to one of their games next year because they've kind of been a low-key powerhouse lately, cranking out a lot of top prospects. But I was familiar with the athleticism and the profile of VJ Edgecombe, whatever, but I really didn't know anything about his story. And on draft night, like the talk of him being interviewed right after being drafted, explaining how he grew up, came from nothing in the Bahamas and his family and how much this means for to them for him to be drafted and knowing that he has generational wealth just immediately upon being selected. Like that was really powerful, right? That's why you watch the draft. Like, I don't mean to be too corny here, but that was unbelievable. Like, and I hate to be too cliche and just buy into him for that reason. But once I look at the rest of the profile and understanding this guy's mentality and what it took for him to get to this point and how he really did beat the odds to reach this point being a lottery pick in the NBA draft, like, I'm in. I'm just saying, I see the star potential, I see the athleticism, and I love what Philly did at the end of the day, getting this guy at number three. You know, he was in the mix of like a top five prospect for most of the process. I think consensus throughout most of the year would have had Ace Bailey at this spot, but you still get a really talented guy. You love the guy's character. It seems like Philly is all in, and he's already buying into the culture there in the few short days he's been a part of the organization. So I really like the move for Philly, and I think that this guy could become a star. Just from the interview factor alone, it worked for me. I'm sure many people watching the draft felt the same way. I do like, again, that they didn't draft necessarily for need, because you look at Edgecombe, he probably profiles closest to like a shooting guard, which, you know, now that the Sixers are fully on like Maxey's timeline and Jared McCain's timeline, they're not as worried as much about contending right now with Joel Embiid. So I would say that there's an argument to be made where maybe they could have looked toward a front court player, just because they already have, assuming both of those guard spots locked up with Maxey and McCain. But I think at the end of the day, like, again, I've just been taking a lot of shots at Sixers fans lately because they've been pissing me off. I do think that the sample size for what we saw from Jerod McCain was way too small to be like, he is a part of the backcourt of the future, especially when you look at his size next to Tyrese Maxey. Not a lot of defensive upside there, not a lot of switchability from that backcourt. So screw it. Take the best player available. Take a super athletic two guard that slots in nicely next to either of those guys. You can bring McCain off the bench. And if you really needed to, you probably could start all three if you really had to. But I just think what we saw from Jerod McCain was awesome. He's clearly a great pick for where Philly got him last year. But to assume he's just like Maxey 2.0 waiting in the wings there in Philly is crazy. And there are absolutely a large portion of Sixers fans that feel like he is already in that tier from like the 20-something games that he played his rookie year when they had nobody else healthy and he was taking all the shots and whatever. So we'll see what Philly goes from here. I do like the pick altogether. And now, can you Sixers fans, can you just shut the fuck up about Ace Bailey? Like, there's still Sixers fans taking a shot at the kid for canceling the interview and saying there's all this drama and saying how they dodged a bullet. Like, whatever, man. We'll see how this all works out because Ace Bailey could be a stud in his own right. But Philly, you got your guy. You should be very happy with VJ Edgecombe. Moving on to number four, Con Knipple of Duke University. Definitely watched this guy play more than nearly any other college prospect just because Duke was really the only team I would watch periodically throughout the year. Like the pick. Seems like a really solid player. Can obviously shoot the ball. Really sturdy frame on him. Seems like he checks all the intangible boxes that you'd want. I hate to be too cliche here, you know, picking on the white guy at the top of the draft. Does he have the same ceiling as everybody else in the top five? Like, trying to be unbiased here? Probably not. But if you're Charlotte, you know, you've taken some big swings with LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller. You just want to get an adult in the building that is going to buy into the culture, that's going to do the little things well, that's going to be a great shooter and a great complement to LaMelo Ball in the backcourt. I think they got that in Con Knipple. Enough of the real analysis. If you guys watch the draft, I mean, I was not familiar with the Knipples, how many brothers there were. There are an overwhelming amount of Knipples. There are five of them. They showed all five brothers, and they started with like the four siblings that obviously weren't drafted when they were doing the post-draft interview. And I was like, oh, like that's so, you know, that's so nice, whatever. They have such a nice family. And like, you look at them all in the face and they all look like they're like 12 in the face because these are young kids, whatever. And then the camera just kind of pans back and you realize that Khan is actually like the second shortest brother or something like that. And you're like, oh my God. And one of the brothers is talking about working him in the post if they lower the rims down or whatever. And I'm like, I believe him. That kid's like 6'7", right? Like Khan himself is like 6'5", but he's got a pretty good frame on him, right? Like he's carrying a significant amount of weight. So he's pretty big for somebody that's 6'5". Like, I don't know, man. Like, is the Knipple family going to be like the next Plumleys where all these guys end up making it and going to Duke? I'm calling my shot now. I feel like that's pretty likely. I don't know how highly recruited the brothers are ranked or if they already have offers or whatever. But if this is like the next Plumlee family where they all go to Duke and they all end up making the league, like, just say you were warned on this podcast, because I think I need to start buying Knipple stock after what I saw on draft night. And then wrapping up the top five, arguably one of the most interesting stories heading into the draft was Ace Bailey, and this was the selection for the Utah Jazz at number five. I love this move by Danny Ainge, just saying, F it, I'm taking who I believe has the highest ceiling as a prospect, and that's who they got in Ace Bailey. There was a lot of smoke saying that Ace's camp wanted him to fall all the way to Washington at six. I want to say it was Washington and maybe Brooklyn at eight or nine, something like that. Those were the two teams that were the desired destination for Ace Bailey and the ridiculous advice that he's getting from his agency team. But if you're Danny Ainge, like, so what? The guy didn't want to work out with you. Like, you guys in the Utah Jazz were in the mix for the number one overall pick all year long. Obviously, the lottery goes completely off the rails and you end up getting the fifth pick instead of what was projected to be at least a top three pick. But guess what? Like, if you're Danny Ainge and the Utah Jazz, you're keeping an eye on these prospects throughout the year. Like, Ace was always in that top two to three conversation. So maybe they became really committed to the idea of Ace Bailey throughout the season anyway and kind of got their hopes up that they were going to have an ability to draft him. And this storm with the agent and the lack of workouts and everything that caused Ace to fall a couple of picks was perfect for the Jazz because they were still able to get their guy. There was an interesting reaction on draft night. Like, it looked like Ace right away was pretty happy, right? Pretty excited to be drafted like any kid would be in that situation. And then later on in the draft, there were whispers like, hey, like, his camp didn't want him to go to Utah. He didn't work out for Utah. And then they're panning the camera over to him and he looks like a lot more somber. And then there was even smoke like the past 48 hours basically saying like, hey, he hasn't had much communication with the Jazz. Like, oh, he's not in Utah yet, whatever, whatever. And then right before I recorded this podcast, the Jazz released some statement saying that they expect to have Ace in the facility tomorrow. Like, things are great. They've communicated with the family and he's excited about joining the Jazz. So whatever. I think long story short, I think that it's a good pick again for the Jazz for all the reasons I explained, gambling on the upside there. And it's a really good fit for Ace Bailey too, right? Like, I think the Jazz have really strong people in leadership positions in place in Utah, right? Danny Ainge, like we just talked about, he's not getting fired anytime soon. Same thing with Coach Will Hardy. They love him there. You know, the problem with Will Hardy is he was almost too good to tank the first couple years that he was the coach of that team. So those guys are going to be in place for a while. You're going to have some consistency with that organization. They have pieces there, right? Like, they have some intriguing young players in Collier and Keontae George, and they drafted Walter Clayton Jr. to pair up with Ace Bailey as well. They also have Lauri Markkanen in place. Like, they have some vets there. Walker Kessler, desirable trade piece. Like, they don't have a ton of stuff taking place on the wings there, so maybe Ace could slot into the starting lineup right away. I also see a path for him to get a lot of shots right away, especially if Utah doesn't mind tanking another year or so anyways and just letting Ace develop the way that he wants to. So I don't see how in any world Washington or even Brooklyn would be a better situation than the Jazz anyway. So, and Ace gets a little bit more money for being drafted a couple slots higher than where he was targeting to end up. So I think it's going to end up being a win for everybody, and I'm rooting for Ace Bailey. I just, again, I think the shit that this guy's taken in the media over the past week or so has just been completely unwarranted just because the guy signed some dumbass as an agent by all accounts, and we're going to see how it plays out. He's going to be taking control of his own career at some point. Like, I will hold him accountable if he ends up being a jerk or, you know, makes mistakes on and off the court. Like, we have plenty of time to judge the kid, but I feel like everything that's taken place that you could poke holes at with Ace Bailey so far can be tied back to a really questionable decision-making on the part of his agent. Now let's talk about all of the major trades that took place during the NBA draft. And let's start off with a move between the Wizards and the Pelicans. Wanted to make sure I covered this one on the pod. In this deal, the Pelicans sent CJ McCollum, Kelly Olynyk, and a future second round pick to the Washington Wizards in exchange for Jordan Poole, Sadiq Bey, and the 40th overall pick. So Sadiq Bey actually had some upside there for a while, and he just hasn't been healthy for a bit. And so I feel like him and Kelly Olynyk, that's a pretty fair swap right there. Same thing with the exchange of second round picks, not much to gain there. So I feel like the net-net of this trade would be CJ McCollum going to the Wizards and Jordan Poole going to the Pelicans. And I feel pretty neutral on this deal independently, right? Like, I totally understand why a team in the Pelicans would want to take a swing on Jordan Poole. He had a much better season last year than a lot of people realize, and definitely improved a ton from that first season where he was on the Wizards, and it was just a total nightmare. He was one of the worst players analytically in all of basketball, just one of the least efficient seasons we've ever seen. But I do think he got a lot better. He's obviously a lot younger than CJ McCollum, so he has a lot more upside. Jordan Poole being like, what, 25, 26, CJ McCollum being like 34, something like that. So again, I can see that argument for the Pelicans, but when I look at that Pelicans backcourt of DeJounte Murray coming off an Achilles injury, right? Now you're adding Jordan Poole to the mix. You also have Jeremiah Fears, a prospect, a smaller guard that you took at number 7 in the draft. And again, didn't watch a lot of him, so I don't have strong Fears opinions, but a lot going on in that backcourt, pretty fair to say, right? And I do feel like when you replace CJ McCollum with Jordan Poole, that yes, the ceiling gets higher, but I feel like the floor of what that team could end up being gets a lot lower as well when you remove an established veteran like CJ McCollum from that locker room. And I don't want a low floor if I'm the New Orleans Pelicans, and when I'm keeping in mind the other move that they made on draft night. So let's pivot to that one real quick, because that Wizards deal was the appetizer. The entree is a deal that the Pelicans did with the Hawks, and this was easily the most shocking move of the entire NBA draft. So in this deal, the Pelicans received the number 13 overall pick, a pick that they used to select Derek Queen from Maryland. And in return, the Atlanta Hawks received the number 23 pick in the draft, in which they used that pick for Asa Newell of Georgia. And they also received a 2026 unprotected first round pick, which is the most favorable of the Pelicans or the Bucks. So again, to repeat, the Pelicans traded 10 spots up in the draft, moving from 23 to 13. And what they paid to get there was a first round pick next year that is unprotected and could be the Pelicans' own pick or the Bucks' pick. Whatever one is more favorable of those two. And this is just a fucking nightmare of a deal by all accounts. Now, the Pelicans recently had some change in the front office. They hired Joe Dumars, who was previously a general manager for a while there, I think, I'm assuming, with the Pistons. Then he went and worked for the NBA for a while and then moved back into either general manager or president of basketball operations role for the Pelicans. So Joe Dumars is back on the scene. This is really the first move that he's made since being a part of this team. This and obviously the deal to trade for Jordan Poole. So he's making moves right away. And I just can't wrap my mind around why the Pelicans would want to take on that much risk. Like, it really has nothing to do with what you think of Derek Queen. Again, don't know a ton about Derek Queen. Obviously, a really intriguing prospect. He's a big man with a lot of unique skills. Seems to have a great feel for the game. Can do some pretty special things on the offensive end of the court. But defensively, there are some real concerns. So he is what he is. He's a fine pick at number 13. But to move up only 10 picks in what is a pretty average draft, especially when we're not talking like moving up from 12 to 2, we're talking 23 to 13, and you're just going to trade your unprotected first next year? Like, let's take a look at just what the Pelicans have going on next year to start, right? I don't want to get too far in the weeds on the Zion Williamson stuff, but this guy, their best player who can't stay healthy to begin with, has some very serious allegations going on. If you guys want to learn more about that, you know, do your own research, dive into that yourself. We'll see if that ends up keeping him off the court for one reason or another next year, but they are very serious allegations around Zion Williamson. Like I just said, DeJounte Murray, one of their better players, at least on paper, coming off a torn Achilles, really traumatic injury that happened midway through the season. So we'll see if and when he gets back next year. And then just keeping in mind the recent success or lack thereof of the New Orleans Pelicans, they've literally never had a 50-win season as a franchise ever. They've never been top five in their conference. They've only been above 500 in four out of their 12 seasons as a franchise. And by the way, they play in a completely loaded Western Conference. I don't know if I had to rank the teams in the West heading into next year, I can't imagine I'd have the Pelicans any higher than, like, even just being as optimistic as possible, like 11? Are they at the 11th best team in the conference out of 15 next year? Like, that gut reaction, not going through the full exercise, that feels fair, and that might even be glass half full for the Pelicans. And even if they surprise, right, everything goes right, Zion plays, he's healthy, the team hits their ceiling, they hit on the Queen pick, they hit on the Fears pick, who they had with 7, so keep in mind, if they really wanted Derek Queen that bad, they could have just taken Derek Queen at 7, but whatever. You know, let's say both those rookies hit, and they have a good season next year. There's still a path for this trade to blow up in their face, because the Bucks, what do they have going on right now, right? Like, I still think it's more likely than not they head into next season with Giannis still on the team. But if they decide, like, hey, you know, Dame's going to miss all of next year, we still just don't have a lot cooking with the rest of the roster, we know the East is pretty open, but we still don't feel good about our odds even with Giannis, and they decide to move on from him, and they get a package back from Giannis that is mostly comprised of, like, future draft capital, and the Bucks are effectively go into a tank, that could still end up being at least a top 10, if not a top 5 pick in next year's draft, and it's not that crazy. Now, again, I do think the Bucks, it's more likely that they run it back, they have Giannis, so they're still, like, a, you know, middling team for the most part in the Eastern Conference, like, whatever. But for there to be two roads for this pick to completely blow up in your face, it is an indefensible, unnecessary risk, and it has, again, nothing to do with Derek Queen. It's just such a crazy move by the Pelicans. On paper, you know, I get it, it doesn't sound that crazy. Okay, one unprotected first-round pick to move up, like, whatever, maybe they really like Queen. It's just, the Pelicans do not have a good enough track record to pull this off, and the West is way too loaded, and I think this deal really stands alone out of all the other draft moves as, like, the one that was really the most interesting and absolutely the most shocking deal of the draft. I love it for the Atlanta Hawks, and I hate it for the New Orleans Pelicans. Keeping it moving to some other trades that we've seen over the past few days, I think this one in particular doesn't count as, like, a draft trade, but it was, like, right after I recorded my most recent podcast. It was before the NBA draft, so we're going to cover it nonetheless, because it does include my Boston Celtics and the Atlanta Hawks, like we just talked about. They did stay busy over the past couple of days. In this trade, the Atlanta Hawks received Kristaps Porzingis and a future second-round pick. The Brooklyn Nets, they were involved in this deal as well. They received Terrence Mann and the 22nd pick in Wednesday's draft, in which they used to select Drake Powell. And finally, my Boston Celtics receives George Niang and a future second-round pick. So really the headline here is the Celtics dumping Kristaps Porzingis and his salary. He goes out to Atlanta, and Brooklyn gets involved in the deal to take on a Terrence Mann contract that is not aging that well, and they get a first-round pick that I believe came from the Hawks as their reward for making the money work in this deal. So let me just start off with the emotional side of the trade. You know, I am very sad to see Kristaps Porzingis leave. I wish Kristaps Porzingis nothing but the best. I still really like the guy. And I know he ended last season on a sour note. We'll talk about that. But when you're a part of a championship team, albeit not as big of a part as maybe some of us expected of Kristaps Porzingis once we made that acquisition, but he was a part of that 2024 title team nonetheless, right? And he was a great guy. said nothing but glowing things about the Celtics, clearly loved being a Celtic, loved living in Boston, was just so happy with his basketball situation. Like, it's just hard to dislike that guy. And you know, looking at his best moment as a Celtic easily was game one of the 2024 NBA Finals. You know, he had missed a lot of time with, I believe, was it a calf strain, or am I making that up, or is that just like the new hotness when it comes to injuries right now? Nonetheless, he got injured in that first round series against Miami, didn't play in any of round two, any of round three, comes back off the bench, game one of the NBA Finals in 2024, and was just dominant. He had this ridiculous stretch where he's blocking multiple shots, he's drilling threes, he's dunking, he's punishing mismatches, and it extended the Celtics lead in the first half to, I think, north of 20 points, and that crowd in the Garden was just apeshit. Completely insane, and it was really all fueled by Kristaps Porzingis getting revenge against his former team, making his presence known, first game back in the lineup. And that really did set the tone, not just for that game where the Celtics ended up winning really comfortably, but obviously cruised for the most part to a pretty easy NBA Finals win. And Kristaps was a part of that. Now, he did get hurt, basically didn't play again till Game 5, the closeout game, just to say he was out there on the court. But nonetheless, he was a part of that title team, so I am going to be sad to see him go. But I do think we had to get rid of him. He's under contract to make $30 million this year. He is expiring contract after next season. The guy that we got back in return, George Niang, he is under contract for this year only as well. Unrestricted free agent next offseason, but he only makes $8 million this year. So there is a $22 million difference for this season, which is obviously multiplied if you are over the luxury tax, if you are over the second apron, you end up paying more if you're Celtics ownership. So they really did have to dump Kristaps' salary, and we didn't have to pay any picks to make that happen, right? I guess maybe we gave up a second-round pick or swapped second-round picks, whatever, but that's pretty negligible in the grand scheme of things, right? We're talking about these massive players and these massive contracts. So the move itself makes sense. I am just bummed to see Kristaps Porzingis leave, but I knew this was coming. The thing that I hate about it is I hate George Niang. Like, I really, really hate George Niang. He is one of those, it's actually kind of impressive how much hate I'm able to generate for this guy with him just being like a pretty average role player in the NBA at this point in time. But he's got a punchable face. I mean, let's start there. Robust frame, we'll say, right? He's a heavier set fellow, which just kind of makes him look, you know, a little bit lazier when he's, you know, meandering up and down the court, whatever. But I have some real, like, personal baggage that I'm carrying from George Niang when he used to be on the Sixers. I mean, right there is a red flag to begin with. And when we played him in the playoffs a couple years ago, there was some weird altercation where Jaylen Brown was trying to make a play over by the Sixers bench, and then the ball was headed in transition the other way. And Niang, who was sitting on the bench, just wrapped up Jaylen Brown's leg and, like, didn't let him move down the court to get back into play. Like, Jaylen Brown's on the court in the game, Niang's on the bench, and he's grabbing Jaylen Brown, preventing him from getting back into play. And, you know, then Brown is talking shit, and they might have had to have been separated or whatever. But I was like, what a, like, just a scumbag loser play by George Niang in that situation, right? Like, there are cameras everywhere, and we saw it clear as day on the broadcast. Another fond memory of rooting against George Niang comes from last year's NBA Cup, in which we played the Cavs. And I think that was when the Cavs obviously had their crazy winning streak to start the season, and Tatum just, like, dropped George Niang on a step back three like a sack of potatoes. Like, he tumbled for like 5 yards, like, into the paint on the step back three, and then Tatum obviously drilled it. So that was a tangent you guys didn't need or ask for, but I gave it to you either way, because I don't like George Niang. I'm telling myself that there's some way, like, you know, Brad's gonna be so active this offseason that he just doesn't end up on my team. But it feels like we're headed that way, because he is a plus 3-point shooter. You know, he obviously has a big frame, so he can guard bigger dudes and whatever, even though his foot speed is miserable. So whatever, he's not a very good player by any means, but he only makes $8 million, and I pray that this is the only year we're going to have him on the team. He is from Massachusetts, so maybe he grew up a Celtics fan, that could give him some brownie points, but I don't want him on my team one way or the other. So that's really the only part of the deal that I hate. So while I'm on this Celtics tangent, I might as well just give them a little extra love, because they are my favorite team, and just tell you about the other moves that they made throughout the NBA draft. They did draft Hugo Gonzalez at pick number 28. Who's a prospect out of Spain. And then they also drafted Amari Williams at pick number 46, a center from Kentucky. Not gonna lie, you know, I stayed watching night one of the draft, just kind of waiting for the Celtics pick at 28 with some anticipation. It's not like I knew like a ton of the people that were listed at best available at that point, but I did recognize some of the names. And when they said Hugo Gonzalez, I obviously had no idea about this guy. Like, seems like a high energy wing. He's like 6'6", hustles really hard, has some great athleticism, but right about now can't really shoot the ball, and it's pretty raw as a prospect, so that doesn't exactly get me super fired up for next year. But hey, with how we're shaping up for next year, this guy could have an opportunity to get minutes. And then when we move on to Amari Williams at pick 46, this one I was actually a little bit more fired up about, especially when you keep in mind the draft capital. There was really no reason for me to be excited about a pick in the middle of the second round. But we needed a big man really bad, because as of right now, the priority for the Celtics should be re-signing Luke Kornet and Al Horford, but there is going to be some competition in the marketplace for those guys. We hope that they enjoy being a Celtic and being a part of the 24 title team enough where they might give the Celtics some sort of discount, or at least they should be the odds-on favorite to stay in Boston heading into their free agency decisions. But as of right now, our only bigs are Kata and Xavier Tillman, which is pretty rough. So I knew we needed to get a big man one way or another in this draft. And the guy we got, Amari Williams from Kentucky, my boss Rob, he's a big Kentucky fan. He was kind of gassing him up, was telling me what I wanted to hear as a Celtics fan. But he's a pretty fascinating prospect. Like, he's absolutely massive. I think he's 7'1 with a 7'6 wingspan. Pretty good rim protector, but the foot speed is questionable, so he can't really defend on the perimeter. So he's really just a good rebounder and rim protector on the defensive end of the court. On the offensive end, though, was completely blindsided when I saw like a 2-minute video of him just like diming guys up, like pushing the ball in transition, making some really nice reads. Dare I say Jokic-esque, you know, second round, who says no? Wasn't drafted during a Taco Bell commercial, but we will take it. He's British, so he's had some Weetabix activations over the past couple months as well, which is always fun. So yeah, in on Big Amari. So that's kind of a fun move for the Celtics. So I think the next move, it might still be Sam Hauser, combining the Drew Holiday deal, combining the Kristaps Porzingis deal. We're now under the second apron, which is massive and was definitely the priority heading into this offseason, especially with no Tatum. But we are still above that first apron, so we still could shed a little bit of money if at all possible. That might be what ownership looks to do. And I do think Sam Hauser could be next. Now, I will say, the Celtics are no longer desperate to shed money. Everyone knows we're under that second apron, so we're right where we want to be in that regard. And I do think Hauser is on a very desirable contract. Like, as crazy as it sounds, he probably has more trade value than Kristaps and Drew Holiday, which again, sounds ridiculous, but keeping in mind the contract and how limiting this new CBA is to all these teams that are trying to make the salary cap work out, he's on a 4-year, $45 million contract. He's still pretty young. He's in the prime of his career. He's under contract for the next 4 years. That contract doesn't go into place until next season. So you think you get a guy that's like got good size, 6'8", 40%+ three-point shooter, completely knocked down, defends better than you'd think, and he's a part of a championship team and completely comfortable in his role. Like, there's real value in a guy like that. Like, there's literally 29 other teams that could use a Sam Hauser, and I'm not over-exaggerating when I say that. So I just hope if we do decide to move on from Sam Hauser, we feel like we can get enough replacement value from Baylor Shireman, who had some flashes during his rookie year. I hope that if we move Sam Hauser, we're getting good value for him. I do expect Trader Brad to come out and make sure that we win that transaction, whether it's through draft capital, whether it's getting through somebody in the front court rotation that can help us a bit. Like, I just think that Sam Hauser has some real value. So if we do look to move on from him, that's what we can expect to get in return. And I do think the priority should still be re-signing Kornet and Al Horford at this time. Now, the other side of the deal, I took way too long to talk about the Hawks there. So apologies to any Hawks fans who are somehow listening to this. But they did get Kristaps Porzingis in a second round pick in this trade. They probably had to give up a first round pick in there to the Nets as well. And they moved on from the Terrence Mann contract. But I think it's a pretty good swing for the Atlanta Hawks, right? Obviously, the determining factor here is how much are you going to get from Kristaps Porzingis? How many games is he actually going to play next year? We assume the mystery illness that plagued him and really reduced his productivity during the playoffs this past year, we assume that that's going to get better and he's going to be healthy and at full speed heading into next season. So if he is out there, like, he is a very unique talent, as everybody understands. Trae Young's really never had like a true stretch five option. And especially when you keep in mind that this is a stretch five option that's also massive. He's an incredible lob threat. And he's an incredible rim protector, and he's all rolled up into one. So I just think that as all these teams in the East are looking around, like making swings with how open it is, this is a very logical play for the Atlanta Hawks. They didn't have to give up too much to get that. They're also getting back Jalen Johnson, returning from injury next year. So that's going to be a massive boost to that roster. They also still have Okongwu in place as what I'm assuming is still going to be their starting center if they decide to ease Kristaps in by bringing him off the bench right away. Like, he's a young, athletic player that can switch and guard multiple positions. Like, I really like Okongwu, and he's the perfect guy to eat up a lot of minutes at the center position, so you are able to manage Kristaps Porzingis throughout the regular season. They also, of course, as a part of that deal with the Pelicans, added Asa Newell from Georgia at pick 23, who's like a hybrid, like forward center, who can give them a lot of energy and athleticism as well. So I do like what the Hawks did in this deal. I hope that Kristaps Porzingis is healthy for them. I wish them the best, and I think it's a very logical swing for the Hawks to make. And overall, like what they cooked up on draft night, especially when you keep in mind that insane deal that they pulled off with the Pelicans. One more deal to talk about here, and this was a trade that I found pretty fascinating between the Suns and the Hornets. In this trade, the Suns received Mark Williams, and the Hornets received Liam McNeely, who they took at the 29th pick in Wednesday's draft, and they also picked up a 2029 first-round pick that is the least favorable between Cleveland, Utah, and Minnesota, and they also picked up Micić back in the deal. This one really confused me. I thought Micić was already on the Hornets. I guess he was on the Suns. That transaction took place. He found his way in Phoenix at some point before this, and now the Hornets just traded for him back, so whatever. The headline of the deal is Mark Williams was traded for the 29 overall pick in Wednesday's draft and a 2029 future first-round pick that is most likely going to be a late pick, right? When we're talking least favorable between three teams, and two of those teams are really well-situated right now in Cleveland and Minnesota, like, pretty safe to assume that pick is going to be, like, 24 or later. So pick 29 on Wednesday and a late pick in 2029, that's not that much for the Suns to pay for Mark Williams. That was my initial reaction, is I just kind of like that swing for the Suns. Like, obviously their front court rotation was miserable. If you guys remember listening to my podcast where I had a Suns fan on, Sean Jones, who's great, of the Sean Jones NBA show, he came on like halfway through the season when there was still some optimism about the Suns, and, you know, things certainly weren't up to par and people weren't happy with the season, but there was still a chance they could make some noise before the playoffs, and we were like gassing up the acquisition of Nick Richards because we just figured with how bad their big men rotation was, like, this guy had to be an upgrade. And, you know, Richards is fine if he's your second or third big, but when the rotation is him and Mason Plumlee and Iguodaro, who they picked up in the second round last year, like, it was just gross. Like, the Phoenix bigs were terrible. And so they made a swing for Mark Williams and really didn't have to give up too much. So I like that move. Obviously, Mark Williams has some massive health question marks, some question marks on defense, but offensively, massive body, huge problem on the offensive glass, great lob threat. Like, I think he's immediately going to be a huge upgrade for that Suns team. I definitely don't love this return for the Hornets, right? Like, if you look at the deal that they had in place with the Lakers at this past trade deadline, I think that was Dalton Connect plus a future unprotected first-round pick from the Lakers in some capacity, so that could be really valuable. Obviously, less valuable once they picked up Luka, but still, you know, a future unprotected first from one team is much more valuable than a future first that's the least favorable between three teams. Plus, we know Connect is going to be pretty solid already. So I feel like the price of Mark Williams actually went down since the trade deadline, which makes a little bit of sense when everybody knew that the Hornets made him available one way or the other. So my main question is, like, what do the Hornets know about Mark Williams? Like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, we genuinely don't know. He is healthy as of right now. But if the Hornets were that desperate to trade him where they tried at the deadline and they settled on, you know, pick 29 in a future late first as the return for your starting center, like, I just would be shocked if there weren't some massive red flags when it comes to his health or something along those lines. Now, it probably is still worth the swing for Phoenix, so I do have to give them credit, and I would call them the quote-unquote winner of this deal, especially when you include the rest of Phoenix's draft. I did like what they had going on. They selected Kamen Malawach from Duke at 10. They also drafted Rashear Fleming at 31 and Kobe Brea at pick 41. So on paper, I'm liking those returns, especially with Malawach in particular, the center from Duke. Like, he's massive, and you might be asking yourself, like, why are we going out and getting two centers? Well, I do think that Phoenix's front court rotation was really that bad, like I explained, and having a younger guy to step in and immediately protect the rim at a really high level and has a skill set that does differentiate from Mark Williams. I think Malawach is much more polished defensively. Mark Williams is much more polished on the offensive end of the court right now, and you can eat up a lot of minutes at center between those two guys, and it really just gives you two swings at the plate at finding a future face of the team's front court, right? So I like that move, and I'm liking what the Suns did on paper during the draft. You look at the Hornets haul, I just want to give them a little bit of love here as well. Obviously, we talked about them getting Con Knipple at pick number 4. They got Liam McNeely at pick number 29 from UConn. They got Sion James, another Duke guy, at pick number 33. And they got Ryan Kalkbrenner at pick number 34 from Creighton, who's a big and a conference defensive player of the year a few different times. So he's immediately going to step in and have an opportunity to eat up a lot of minutes at the center position for Charlotte right away. And I do just think that there is like a bit of a cleaning house that needs to take place in Charlotte. Like, things just don't seem to be on the right path over the past several years with the Hornets, like their culture, everything like that. It seems to be improving now that they have Charles Lee and they have, four valuable draft picks where they were able to make their own swing. So I like what the Hornets did in the net as well. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that there is something pretty messed up with Mark Williams if his price was that low. And no team would have a better understanding of that than the Charlotte Hornets. Now, the final team that I want to talk about when it comes to the NBA draft is the Brooklyn Nets. They had a very busy night one of the draft on Wednesday night because they made 5 selections. To go through a list of their draft haul, they drafted Yegor Demon at pick number 8, Nolan Traore at pick number 19, Drake Powell at pick number 22, Ben Sarif at pick number 26, and Danny Wolfe at pick number 27. Now, I'm going to keep it a buck. I really don't know who most of those people are. Like, I've heard of Demon, I've heard of Danny Wolfe, the three in the middle really doesn't ring a bell whatsoever. So I'm not evaluating these prospects and being like, they did good, they did bad, whatever. I just thought it was pretty surprising that they actually made all of those first round picks. And it probably worked against the Nets that teams recognized that they had 5 picks heading into draft night, that it's assumed that they would want to look to package some of those picks to move up in the first round or at least get some draft capital in future years. And the Nets front office just said, F it, we're just going to draft them all. And so I think it's pretty funny that the Nets had a lot of buzz heading into the offseason about, like, they were a potential suitor for Giannis. They have all this cap room. They're looking to get active on the trade block. A lot of teams want Cam Johnson. Like, could they be this, not contender, but like sneaky competitive team that's just kind of lurking in a wide open Eastern Conference? And there was real buzz around the Nets at this point. And I just feel like all of that is out the window. Again, not to say that these 5 guys are going to stink, but I will say the draft experts didn't love the Nets haul for having first round picks. It seems like they got pretty low grades across the board, but I'm not really taking that into account. But what I am saying is it's just hard to carve out minutes for 5 first round picks for any team, right? Like, the Nets already had a lot of young players, and it does seem like they got the coaching decision right. Like, Jordy Fernandez did a fantastic job with that Nets team and their defense specifically during last season, so I get why they had some positive buzz heading into the offseason, but I always just thought it was laughable that they were going to go out and pull off a Giannis trade, or they were going to go out and pull off a trade for a massive star and suddenly get competitive heading into next season. It just feels like they're headed toward at least one more year of tanking, probably another 2 or 3, just based on the decision to take all these guys and the fact that odds are, you know, at least 2 or 3 of them just aren't going to work out whatsoever. And, you know, it's going to be hard for all those guys to get minutes and develop the way they want. Like, there's a good chance that they end up having to move on from one of these 5 guys before they even realize what they have in the prospect. And then some other team might strike gold on one of these guys on their second stop. So I just think it's a really confusing decision for the Nets to make all those draft picks. Again, maybe teams were just lowering the price on those picks because they knew that they didn't want to make all of them, and the Nets just made the best out of a bad situation or whatever. But it's just kind of impressive that they had 5 first round picks, which again is an NBA record for the first round, and nobody's really happy with what the Nets did. So I just think it's going to be at least 1 to 2 more years of rebuilding in Brooklyn. And so that brings us to the final draft exercise that we're going to do, where I arbitrarily assign a draft winner and a draft loser. Keep in mind, not an expert on any of these prospects, so take it with a grain of salt. But with all that in mind, I would say that the winner of the draft, no questions asked, it's the Hawks. It's the Hawks. It comes back to that Hawks-Pelicans deal that we talked about, in which they traded back 10 picks and took on an unprotected first-round pick that's likely going to be really good next year in a draft that might even be better than what we saw last night. So I don't care what everybody else got as far as prospects. Some guys are going to have stars. Some guys are going to have busts. The Hawks are the winner because of the value that they were able to get from that deal last night alone. And who knows, even as a Pelican season, like, if it does turn for the worst or the Bucks are really starting to bottom out, something like that, like, that pick's only going to gain value, and they're going to be able to have that as a leverage chip for maybe the Pelicans have a change of heart. They want to trade for it back. Maybe the Bucks want their own pick back. Like, it could be really, really valuable. And I just think that the Hawks got a ton of value, all things considered. And within the same vein, my biggest loser of the 2025 NBA draft is the Pelicans. Like, and it has nothing to do with Jeremiah Fears and what I think of him as a prospect. Same thing with Derek Queen, who they got at pick number 13. It's just such a ridiculous risk that, like, if you're going to punt on that much value during the NBA draft, and every single expert, every single team around the league is completely puzzled why you would take on all that risk, like, that makes you the loser of the draft. I'm sorry. Like, they can hit on both of those picks, and it could still be a miserable decision to trade their future first next year. So I understand that's a bit of a cop-out to just say, like, that specific trade determined the winner and the loser of the draft. So if I really had to pick a winner that's not from that trade, I would say it's the Charlotte Hornets. I just like what they were able to do as a total haul, getting major prospects from major programs in Con Knipple at 4, McNeely at 29, Sion James at 33, and Kalkbrenner at 34. That just feels like a pretty good return for a Hornets team that is hopefully finally trending in the right direction. And I would just say the biggest loser of the night would probably be the Brooklyn Nets, just because, again, they had 8 first-round picks in the first round, and nobody seems to be happy with the return on that. And it's just going to be really tough to get all those guys the minutes that they need in order to develop those guys and let them hit their ceiling as prospects. I just find it hard to believe that that's going to happen in Brooklyn. So I think it actually becomes a detriment when you make that many first-round picks. So for that reason, the Nets are the loser in my book. And finally, the piece of news that I wanted to talk about that came out earlier today was the Raptors' decision to move on from president of basketball operations Masai Ujiri. He had a pretty tough run post-2019, and obviously that was an incredible move that he pulled off, trading DeMar DeRozan and some other pieces for Kawhi Leonard. And I think that was like the last superstar trade that Masai pulled off that didn't have like a million first-round picks in it. So the price that he paid to get Kawhi Leonard was really insane when you think about it, even though it was only a one-year rental. Like, really, he could have paid whatever price. He could have thrown in 7 first-round picks in the deal, and it would have been worth it because they went on to win that 2019 title. It felt like Masai stock was at an all-time high, right? Like, that guy was like the prize in NBA front offices after 2019, and deservedly so. But ever since then, more or less irrelevant. Like, they slowly had that championship core erode away, like, didn't like the return that they got for Pascal Siakam. I don't remember the return they got from Fred VanVleet. I think VanVleet, they just lost for nothing in free agency. And they just have a really bizarre roster that I've been really low on. Like, I don't see how anyone could be bullish on the Raptors. And they have some weird pieces. Like, they made a controversial decision to trade for Brandon Ingram at the trade deadline, who was hurt, so we haven't seen him suit up for the Raptors yet. They drafted Colin Murray-Boyles at pick number 9 in this year's drafts, who, again, I don't really have strong opinions on, so that is what it is. But it just seems like a very bizarre roster that is, like, perfectly situated to be in the middle of nowhere because they have a lot of money going to Quickly, a lot of money that's going to be going to Scottie Barnes eventually if it hasn't already kicked in. Brandon Ingram in place, you know, Jakob Poeltl in place. RJ Barrett is there as well. Guys that are young but not crazy young, and I don't think that there's a lot of ceiling that those guys haven't already hit. So it does kind of make sense that the Raptors would sour on Masai and look to make a change in the front office. Like, it's a really hard job to hold down, but it's just a crazy move to let that guy make a big swing at the deadline like what he did trading for Brandon Ingram, and then you let him get one last draft off before laying him off. Like, what are we talking about? What is the logic behind letting a guy make picks that determine the future of your team over the next 5 to 10 years and then firing him the next morning? Like, if you're really sure you wanted to move on from him, wouldn't you want your personnel in the building to get their fingerprints on the 2025 draft? Like, that just seems like a no-brainer to me. Now, again, not to say that maybe they really didn't trust his judgment in the draft, and maybe they were even aligned, like the rest of the front office was aligned in the decisions that Masai was going to make anyway, and those picks could end up hitting, like, whatever, but it's just a crazy storyline out of Toronto. And I just, again, felt like this team was kind of directionless, like they were headed toward purgatory where they're just in the middle of nowhere, good enough to, you know, be competitive and win some games, whatever, but not good enough to make any real noise. And at the same time, they're not bad enough to actually bottom out and get to the top of the draft where you do have an opportunity to draft some generational talent. I didn't feel good about the Raptors before today, and the news that they fired Masai one day after the NBA draft just signals organizational incompetence, and I feel even worse about the Raptors now. So just really weird move coming out of Toronto, and we'll see who they look to replace him with in the coming weeks. So before I let you guys go, I did just want to give you my draft gripes on my way out the door, right? A couple of changes that I would make with the NBA draft if they let me run the show. Starting off with the fact that, again, it just doesn't need to be 2 nights long. Like, nobody ever watched the NBA draft over the past 5 decades and was like, you know, we should really just make a second night for round 2 of the draft specifically. Like, nobody asked for it. Nobody needed it. Just drags out the process even more. So I think that, in a nutshell, is pretty stupid. And like I said on previous podcasts, if they really did decide, like, that decision was made from people that are monitoring the money and just trying to milk as much out of the draft as physically possible, it needs to go to 2 nights. Like, whatever. I get it. Everybody's got to make a dollar at the end of the day. But if you're going to make it two nights, it needs to be night one on Thursday. Draft on Wednesday night is a crazy move. Draft on Thursday is what it's been for the NFL draft. It's what it's been for the NBA draft forever and always. Not sure what other sports do, but really could care less. I just feel like Thursday is a great draft day. Set the tone for the weekend, right? And if you wanted to make it 2 days, you have night one on Thursday and night two on Friday. I don't care. Make people watch the draft on a Friday night if they're really dedicated enough to care about round two anyways. That would be my two cents on that. And really the biggest gripe that I have is that like the pick trading, pick swapping is completely out of hand. Now, I'm not saying that teams shouldn't do it, but as a viewer and somebody that does care about the product of the NBA draft as a whole, especially as a television product, like it is a nightmare to follow. It makes no sense. And to give you an idea of just how crazy the trading and pick swapping has gotten, after pick 12 in the 2025 NBA draft, after pick 12, there were only five picks the rest of the draft that were not traded and not swapped. So only five teams actually made their own picks from that point forward in the draft, from pick 12 onward. I think there were like two in the top 12 that were traded or swapped or something like that. So for the most part, it's still the teams that land at the top of the draft, stay at that spot, keep their own pick, and make that selection. But after that point, once you get to the late lottery and beyond, it's just like complete bedlam of where these picks are going. And what that leads for is a ton of confusion when you're actually watching the draft. Like, the best example that I can have for this is the Kevin Durant deal went through on Sunday morning. Sunday morning, Kevin Durant is traded from the Suns to the Rockets in exchange, in part, for the number 10 pick, right? Number 10 pick was arguably the centerpiece of that deal. There were other pieces involved. Don't matter for the sake of this point right here. So number 10 is now being selected by the Phoenix Suns. That took place on Sunday morning. Night one of the draft was on Wednesday night. So there's a full three business days in the mix there. Yet, because the trade did not officially go through yet, when Malawach gets drafted at pick number 10, it's still the Rockets logo on the screen, and obviously, yes, the announcers are telling us that it's going to Phoenix and whatever, but it's a Rockets logo on the screen. He gets a hat that says Houston Rockets, and he's got to take all those photos, some of the happiest moments of his entire life, and he's wearing a hat of a team that did not draft him. Like, it's just, it's so stupid. How do we not figure that out after 3 days? I understand there are some trades in the moment that are like bang, bang, they happen while they're on the clock, and we can't update the graphics and we can't get them the right hat. But like the fact that we're so worried about the deal not being official, where like the TV product makes no sense and it's completely impossible to follow, is just a decision I don't agree with at that point, right? Even after the draft, as I'm combing through like the full draft board and the full results of every single team, like it's still impossible to follow with how many times these picks were traded and swapped. Like it's just a nightmare at this point. And I know that it's not really a problem that these teams should have the flexibility to trade and swap these picks accordingly. I get all that, but there's just something we need to do about the presentation of the draft with the hats and the graphics that's better for the people that are watching the draft, because it's literally impossible to follow as of right now. So that's going to do it for this podcast today. Hopefully you guys enjoyed my NBA draft analysis. Hopefully you just enjoyed watching the draft as a whole. And right now we're in a pretty fun spot in the NBA calendar, right? It's hard to believe that the NBA champion was determined less than a week ago, right? You have a three-day turnaround to the NBA draft. And now as I sit here and record on Friday the 27th, we're only 4 days away from the official start of NBA free agency. Realistically, we're going to start getting the news that teams have agreed in terms to a contract and everything like that. That'll probably start in about 2 days. So it's really going to pick up. It's not the most insane free agent class, but we know there's a lot of exciting trades to come. We know that there's going to be some big signings that could be the ultimate difference for some teams that are contenders. Like, again, look at what the Thunder did last year. The decision to trade Josh Giddey for Alex Caruso around this point in the offseason. They also went out and acquired Isaiah Hartenstein in free agency. Like, those are two championship-defining moves. I don't need to explain to you guys how important those two were to the Thunder's ultimate championship run. So it's an exciting time in the offseason. It's crazy that it's all back-to-back-to-back like this between the finals, the draft, and free agency, but we are just 4 days away. So tentatively, my plan is to get you guys a podcast probably on like the 2nd. That way we get like the first 48 hours of official deals in the books, and hopefully we'll have a few major storylines to talk about at that point. So the 2nd would be on Wednesday. Tentatively planning to get you guys a podcast then before I travel home to see some family and friends. So that's going to do it for this podcast. Be sure to follow at Words with Wallace on everything that includes Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I know I've been teasing a lot of social media content lately that I haven't delivered on, but it will be a busy weekend for me cranking out some reels, cranking out my breakdown of trades in like 60 seconds or less. So be sure to follow the show at Words with Wallace on all social media platforms and support my content there. Definitely helps a lot. And I will talk to you guys next week. Peace.